morning. Welcome to another edition of Marketing Pulpit International New York with yours truly, Dennis Shipman. It's 51 degrees and cloudy here in Brooklyn, New York. Not bad, just damp. I hope you had a great weekend. Had an interesting one, to say the least. We're still social distancing, a new verb, doubtless, in response to coronavirus, which is sort of flattening. We're plateauing somewhat in New York, but given the size of the population, say 8 million, but you could tack on easily another million, 2 million to that for undocumented persons throughout the world that live in New York, Africans, Asians, and everything in between. And then you have a fairly close facsimile of the demographic, the population there in the city. Over 2,000 bridges, 22 deemed major. So we were hit relatively hard here, and the governor is not committing to a specific date for opening, and I think this is prudent. I think without mass testing, diagnostic, and serologic, that we need to pump the brakes, irrespective of what Chump the Brain Dead Comic Carnival Bark, a.k.a. Clueless Clown, wants to do. Biden has some really hard-hitting ads out, and I've been saying this for a long time, that the Timidocrats don't need to reinvent the wheel. They ought to. They simply need to build on what is already evident. You know, through Trump's words and actions and deeds, and that is damning enough. I mean, you don't have to do anything else. Just use the man's words. Words against them, you know, little linguistic jujitsu, if you will, using his words against him. So we don't know where we're going to be at. I was just looking at some numbers. We're at 22% unemployment. During the Great Depression, the number was 25%. So 24.9% of the population had lost their job, roughly one out of every four workers. And we're at 22 million now. So I didn't mean to say 22%. I mean 22 million. I don't know what the percentage is. I mean, at some point during the break, we could look it up. But I suspect that we're coming perilously close to Great Depression numbers, which, again, were 25% or one out of every four Americans in 1933, during the height of the Great Depression, had no work. So, and many of these people, this was also during the Dust Bowl when many people, including myself, weren't around, nor were my parents, I don't think. This was 90 years ago. But all the topsoil in the Midwest, for whatever reason, decided to take a vacation and just blow away. And leaving those fields fallow, you know, in the Midwest, which we consider our breadbasket, you know, roughly Nebraska out to Iowa, you know, those solidly western states, or Midwest to the west, you know, that whole area there was badly impacted. So people did a lot of creative, you know, they lived closer to nature, closer to the grid, off the grid, rather, as we say. Well, you know, telephone wasn't widely available, nor was electricity. A lot of these rural areas weren't electrified until the 50s, you know, and in some cases the 60s and the 70s. So these people relied heavily on, you know, kerosene lanterns and that sort of thing. So it was a very dangerous, very perilous existence that state that's going to be very hard hit, simply because of the size of its population. And Abbott, the governor over there, refused to close the state completely. You have DeSantis in Florida doing the same thing, opening the beaches up, and people are aghast at the sheer stupidity. You know, and this is typically privileged whites that want to have the right to infect you and I. You know, because they feel that the rules, see, and this is the thing that I try to explain to black folks, and they don't want to hear it, because they benefit personally from structural racism and inequity. You know, I can't name the amount of black folks in positions of public trust. You know, in other words, they can get stuff done. I would have said it another way if we weren't on radio, even internet radio. You have to be careful, somewhat. Try to be a wholesome show. At any rate, you know, I can't tell you the sheer amount of them tell me that, you know, instead of doing a job, oh, I'm going to pray for you, oh, good luck, oh, you got to apply just like everybody. I mean, you know. I mean, it's incredible, man. And I don't know. Maybe it's a function of my age, how I'm getting older and I'm starting to see things clearly. I mean, the blinders have dropped off my eyes. And for the last, I don't know, since I've been woodshedding, my life has come into stark relief in terms of being able to not. And I don't want to say give people the benefit of the doubt. I'll still do that. But for the most part, you can't rely on any man or any woman. And during the Great Depression in the early part of the, or, you know, early to mid-30s, Roosevelt was the president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He ordered in the Social Security Act, 1933, which ameliorated a lot of the poverty that we see, you know, with pensioners. That's what it was mainly for, and orphan children. So, and then it was expanded during the Johnson administration early. In the 60s, after the Kennedy assassination, you know, became the Great Society program. So the welfare state was born. And we can go off into a socioeconomic discussion. Maybe we ought to in another show about the welfare state, because this is the problem that we're encountering now, where the Trump administration is ensuring that its pockets and the pockets of its closest allies, friends, and family, you know, are being lined. As a matter of fact, there was a great piece in the the Washington Post about the wife of Eric Trump and the paramour of Donald Trump Jr. receiving substantial cash payments from the campaign, ostensibly for work they've done. And these payments totaled almost $300,000, over $300,000, which would seem to me on its face to be a campaign finance violation, you know. But this sort of thing has been going on. How would I say, unabated since Trump's inauguration, January 21st, 2016. So, I mean, I think it's the unfairness that are causing some people to push back, you know, even against these mobs. You know, Trump wants his way. You know, what my mother used to say, chump wants his cake and eat it too. So, you know, on the one hand, he's saying everybody should maintain social distancing. And on the other hand, you know, in response to some, again, you know, white protesters, they were comprised primarily of whites. But you have some blacks on some of the groups that I'm on social media, that are echoing the party line, oh, we need to get back to work and blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, you have a right to do what you want to do, but you don't have a right to endanger my life in the process. And I think these state governments and counties and, you know, small municipalities have struck a balance between, you know, person's constitutional right to assemble and, you know, freedom of speech and that sort of thing, and the right of the rest of us to be free of a lethal pathogen that, you know, once contracted, you know, many don't survive, and the ones that do survive, you know, some are quote-unquote asymptomatic, which means they've shown no symptoms of the virus or have a viral load. Whereas other people are severely compromised for the rest of their life. Their lungs are scarred, and there's some anecdotal reporting on the fact that it damages other parts of the body, internal organs. I'm not a physician or a hard scientist. I don't have a degree in physics, chemistry, biochemistry, biology, that sort of thing. But I do understand some of the science upon which these reports are predicated. So I think that, as I was saying on social media this morning, what's going to happen is that Trump is going to continue to push for, you know, a hard date to reopen because his you know, let's face it, his campaign or, you know, re-election aspirations rest precariously on the economy. It's the only thing he has to run on. He has nothing else. His accomplishments, you know, beyond rolling back, wholesale rollback of regulations, which in some cases help, which in some cases hinder. The regulations that he needs to roll back, he doesn't. Like in the trucking industry, you know, with hours of service, and that he should go after that, but he won't touch that. The trucking industry has been overregulated since the 80s, you know, since 1980 when they deregulated altogether. And then the Department of Transportation started taking a heavy hand towards truckers. And 90% of everything that you have in your house has been delivered by a truck at some point, you know, point of origin, point of manufacturer to point of origin to end user. You got to buy a truck or you went to a big box store and picked it up, but it was delivered by a tractor and trailer. Some, you know, working stiff, you know, making 40 grand a year that drove all night to get your washing machine to you. That's a fact. We had a trucking company for many, many years, and I still have a Class A CDL. I don't drive any longer, but once in a while I'll take out a load just to keep my chops, keep sharp. You know, you have to have a lot of skills, and this economy illustrates it no better than anything. Because during the Great Depression, these people did everything. You know, they were hunter-gatherers. I mean, you name it. They did it. Farmers, you know, so they, you know, pastoral. The whole nine. The gamut of different lifestyles necessary to survive. You know, they had to hunt and gather, forage, you know, because there were no, you know, you couldn't go to a supermarket in the 30s and expect to get any. First of all, if you had money. So these people, you know, especially in rural areas, I'm not talking about the cities. The cities is a different, you know, different dynamic altogether. It's a different phenomena there, whereas they had to stand on soup lines. They had to rely on deliveries and they, you know, to the supermarkets and that sort of thing, soup kitchens, you know, people that weren't well off. But persons that lived in the country and rural existence, these people got out here and hunted, man, you know, small game, large game, whatever. And that's how they survived. And they had a lot of skills, you know. They could drive everything. You know, nowadays, you know, they joke that the anti-theft deterrent in your car is a manual transmission because nobody can drive it anymore except, you know, persons my age and, you know, some younger ones that learn how to drive from, you know, father, older brother, uncle, aunt, somebody that actually like to drive manual transmissions, you know. Everybody. I was just reflecting on it. So I was thinking about this, I don't know, because of these skill sets that are needed in this day and time. But I was thinking about my cousins and, you know, some of my friends, and everybody drives a stick. And I, Dennis, why are you on it? Yeah, well, it's important. I mean, you know, because, you know, some older vehicles, you know, say these newfangled vehicles, you know, break down for whatever reason. You know, I have a lot of computer. I have, you know, relatively late model cars. Not all of them. Most of them are manual. Manual means they have fuses, batteries, and alternator. They don't have any computerized parts, but I do have one that does have a computer in it. But at any rate, it's a manual, by the way, 6-speed. I years ago, when I was a kid, maybe 11, 12, somewhere around there, 13, you know, we used to hunt. You know, I had long guns all my life. And living in the city, you know, growing up in the city, you don't often get a chance to hunt and fish and that sort of thing. And I gotten away from it, but I did it as a kid. So all these skill sets, like I was saying, you know, the one with the, you know, being able to drive manual transmission, hunting, fishing, foraging, these skills are coming in handy now because I have, you know, obviously I split my time between the city and the country, and I've been holed up in the country simply because, you know, the odds are, I'm not immunocompromised by any means, stretch of the imagination. I'm an older guy. I never, you know, hid that fact, but, you know, I stay in relatively decent shape. I'm not in the best shape I can be. I don't exercise by far enough, and that's something that I've been trying to work on, but, you know, I can have excuses all day and do have excuses for why I don't, but I try to do something, if only isometrics, you know, on a daily basis to at least not allow my muscles to atrophy. So, and I do go out in the yard and, you know, not run around, but, you know, move wood and that sort of thing, tidy up. So that little bit of exercise helps out. Just, you know, minor. You don't have to do a lot. So that's what I'm trying to get into, and that's what I'm trying to encourage people to do in this day and time, because our whole zeitgeist in this country has changed forever. The dynamic here, socioeconomic, is going to change. People are going to re-look at how they conduct commerce. You know, in the late 1800s, I would say up until present day, Sears and Roebuck, major mail order retailer, established the model for the Amazons, eBays, the Alibabas, the big e-commerce giants that we see, you know, just dominating, monopolizing almost the retail sector now. So you have Walmart getting into in Home Depot, Lowe's, the other big box stores, especially big box stores, getting into the act. And, you know, even Target has changed its business model to incorporate a mail order component. You know, so people that think that this mail order component, you know, is something that's, you know, is relatively new, 10, 15, 20 years. No, it's not. You know, Sears and Roebuck had it over 150 years ago. You know, you get a catalog from Sears and Roebuck, it was coveted. You know, it would typically be dog-eared from use. People looking in there, you know, farmers and homemakers, you know, and it was everything. It was general store, and you put in your order, you know, you sent the money in, a check or money order, and several weeks later, by postal service or United Parcel Service, one of the big, you know, there was no FedEx at that time, you know, but United Parcel's been around for a long time, and you would get your item. They would deliver it right to your home. So, you know, fast forward, you know, 80, 90 years, and then you have, you know, your e-commerce giants like Amazon. And the only point that human capitalism is employed, pun intended, in these organizations and these companies is when they're picking an order, literally putting it together. But there's some evidence that can be those workers can be displaced by robots and artificial intelligence. So I think that the leisure society that we've been talking about for many, many, many years is upon us. I think that it's this pandemic is going to auger it in a lot quicker than we had hoped, because, you know, people aren't going to feel safe going into these offices and, you know, possibly contracting, you know, a lethal virus. And if it's not lethal, if you're one of the fortunate ones to be asymptomatic, the odds are still that, you know, it might do some sort of damage to you if you do unfortunately contract it, or worse, bring it home to your family. You know, young children in your family who might be immunocompromised, or older, elderly parents or grandparents who might be living with you that are immunocompromised or have some sort of underlying health issue. You know, that it would literally be a death sentence for these people. So let's take a brief break, and we'll be back after the break and continue discussing our transitioning society due to coronavirus.
Looking for a hit multimedia management company that can manage you, your service, product, or your next multimedia project? Let East New York Management take you, your service, or your product to the next level. At East New York Management, we can produce and post-produce your project into a sleek finished product. We write scripts, slow-mos, blurbs, and spots that are tight, hot, and funky. Liners that flow smoothly with wit as well as with verb. We also manage talent, produce, and post-produce shows that are on the cutting edge, reflecting the undeniable influence of hip-hop on pop culture. The most important thing that we can bring to your product is energy, enthusiasm, and a love for the creative process. Look for us on the World Wide Web at www.eastnewyorkmanagement.net. Call us at 347-846-8447 or email us at contact@eastnewyorkmanagement.net. Do not waste another minute with whack, boring, and uncreative multimedia and talent management companies. Bring your talent or project to East New York Management. Let East New York Management take you, your service, or your product to the next level.
And welcome back to the final segment of Marketing Pulp in the National New York Edition with yours truly, Dennis Shipman. It's 51 degrees and cloudy here in Brooklyn, New York. And we were talking about how the economy is forever changed in this country. You know, a lot of employers are thinking about this now and how to, as they struggle, grapple with how to bring back workers. And I think that a lot of companies that don't require workers to congregate to assemble, and well, even from a managerial perspective, it might be easier to have these people, you know, in one central or several locations, you know, where they're overseen by a supervisor and ensure that the work product is, I don't know. It depends on, you know, you know, even if you have that sort of environment, you know, you get people that loaf around, loaf off, screw around, they don't do their job. You know, I worked in organizations like that. So, you know, I'm not really sure if the telecommuting part is going to take off, but I think in the government it is already, you know, and in state government, federal and state government, they already have telecommuting options. So that's definitely here to stay. I wonder, you know, if I could pose a question as a social scientist, if it's going to take off as a consequence of this pandemic. And I think, yes, I think the answer is emphatically, yeah. And people can start, I mean, it's going to impact other segments of the economy, like the real estate market, because you're going to have underperforming commercial real estate. You're going to have a glut of it, which may be good, may be bad. It depends. A lot of property owners are going to have to start reimagining how they use their space and, you know, zoning and that sort of thing. So we're in a transition. We're in it. So we don't tend to see the big picture associated with it. But we're going to discuss it more over the coming weeks. I don't know what is going to become of this pandemic, how it plays out, or when the country is going to largely try to resume some semblance of normalcy, but we'll see, and we'll keep you abreast right here at Marketing Pulpit, MPI, New York. Stay tuned for my co-host on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. We're a terrestrial, WOLAM, in D.C., flagship station of One, where information is power. And we'll be back next week, so keep it tuned right here. Marketing Bubble International, New York, yours truly, Dennis Shipman. Have a great and blessed week.